It's hour one of the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Why do we never get...
Happy Tuesday, everyone. Beautiful day here in sunny Santa Cruz. We start off today with, well, a sad disaster, yes, in Fiji. We have friends in Fiji who are getting reports on how Coral Island, one of the native islands, was pummeled. We'll talk about that a little bit later if it comes up again. It's very interesting to see how disaster relief happens these days. So that's going on. That happened this weekend. I think it was a Saturday night in Fiji. The other sad news is that Wesley Clark, a legendary computer engineer, died at 88. His work largely influenced the design of early mini computers and CAD software and graphical user interfaces. He died Monday night. To talk about that a little bit, we bring on Bruce Damer from the DigiBarn, who knew Wesley and has a personal connection with him as well, and involving both him and his technology. Bruce, are you there?
I'm here, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about Wesley Clark, Bruce.
Well, Wes Clark, not the general, that's not General Wesley Clark, worked in the 50s at Lincoln Laboratory and then moved on in the 60s. And I call him the father of personal interactive computing. Mm. In that he actually brought to life the very first computers where one user sat in front of a screen and interacted with it.
Oh, the one-on-one interface, yeah.
One-on-one interface with graphics, not just a batch punch card job. Mm. And one of those users was Ivan Sutherland, who created Sketchpad on one of Wes's computers. It was the first drawing. He drew directly onto the screen.
Oh, yeah.
And created the first CAD program. And then he went on to create the Link, which really was considered the first sort of personal computer in 1962, 63, where you actually built these things from kits and they went into laboratories and even a private home.
That was before the PDPs even, right? The famous DEC digital equipment machines. Weren't they inspired by the Link?
Yeah, they were. Apart from the PDP-1, which came before, Gordon Bell took the design of the Link. And Gordon's company, Digital Equipment, had made the modules for the Link, and then they created all these PDP-6 and PDP-8 machines in the 1960s, which Unix was written, you know, a ton of stuff came out, but the Link was the missing link behind it all. It was the ancestor.
So he really was one of the grandfathers of today's computers, the personal one-on-one graphical user interface for playing with computers. It was in his mind back in those days.
Yeah, and it was in the minds of others, but in fact, Wes was the first person to say, let's build them. And he designed the TX-0, TX-2, and then the Link and made it real. And Doug Engelbart's group was inspired by this. And then in a famous taxi ride in the mid-60s, they were considering creating the ARPANET with Bob Taylor's group at DARPA. And a comment by Wes Clark, which said, don't connect the mainframes together. Use small computers in between them and base it on the Link. And so they created the first router, the IMP, and that launched the ARPANET in 1969, which became, of course, the Internet everybody uses every single day.
So he has ties to the origin of the Internet itself. He's one of those.
Yeah.
He more than Al Gore, I guess.
Very much more. So Wes really, he's sort of an unsung hero in my mind. That's why we did all that work in 2007 with the original team to restore a Link in the DigiBarn.
Tell us about that a little bit. This is actually a 1961 or 2 computer.
It's probably 1963.
63? Okay, so that's actually working. And it's here in Santa Cruz County at the DigiBarn.
It's at the DigiBarn, and it's a great big piece of 4 modules and a great big refrigerator-sized cabinet, but it does plug into a regular wall socket.
Yeah.
And you can run it, and it was used in a private home in the mid-60s by Mary Ellen Wilkes, a woman who wrote its operating system.
She actually proved the point that you could take it home.
Yeah, it was the first computer in a private residence. You know, it didn't need an air-conditioned room. It was not bolted to the wall and racked.
No, what'd you say? It was more on the grand piano level footprint?
More of that. Although she put a potted plant on top of it, and there's a famous photo of her programming away in her parents' house in Baltimore.
Classic.
Classic, yeah. She was just honored in Germany for a major honor for women in computing.
Yeah, he told me about one of his early machines went to John Lilly for doing dolphin research.
Yeah, and in fact, when they saw how John had put it, because it was a computer used for laboratory research, it had probes and interfaces that you could probe a cat's brain, and John was using it to record and to communicate sound into the dolphin tank.
So we can have some interspecies communications.
Yeah, and it was really the first computer used in that way. And when they saw that the link was sitting, like, not that far, and the dolphins could literally probably spit water and hit it and probably short it out, I think he didn't get a renewal of his contract.
Yeah. Oh, but at least he was exposed to that kind of thinking early. He seemed to be somewhat wistful about the whole thing. We got to go. So any summary?
Just that an unsung hero is becoming more recognized. It gave us the world in which we live. It has just passed as of yesterday. And every time you look at a computer screen or you touch a phone or a tablet, you're touching Wes Clark's vision of 1960.
Oh, good. Well, may he have a great journey. I hope we have some kind of interdimensional communication because of his intelligence.
Yeah, every day.
All right, man. Well, thanks for the update, and we'll catch you real soon.
We'll do it. Thank you, Dr. Future, and Mrs. Future.
And that's Dr. Bruce Damer from the DigiBarn and currently at the university doing some origin of life research.
Right. And see it on DigiBarn.com.
DigiBarn.com. Okay, thanks, Bruce.
All right.
Welcome. Right.
Okay. More with the Dr. Future Show when we come back from a few sponsors here. Hang tight.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Yeah. The origins of computing. It's just a handful of people. But now we all get to share in that heritage.
Boy. The first generation of this whole new era is beginning to pass, and the digital natives are growing up, and the transfer crossovers like us are watching it all happen, watching the world shift and change before our eyes. Here comes the future.
And what do we have in the future? Well, you know, in the top of the news, we all heard about Apple and the iPhone FBI controversy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, our Washington, D.C. agents are telling us that there's a big protest going on in Washington, D.C. to say, yay, Apple, resist. Resist the forces that would create a backdoor to the private device.
Well, the idea is that you bought the machine, and you bought it with the idea that it had that level of privacy.
It's your property. It's your privacy.
It's kind of like your DNA in a way. Mm-hmm. So to share your DNA, you take very seriously.
Mm-hmm. And really, governments think that they can just like be kings and pass laws that are totally ignorant of the situation and how it affects the actual devices and the industry that's built around them. And just because they want the power, they think they can coerce private business to follow their decrees.
Well, I think the thing is that we all can agree that there are circumstances where it would be good to have access to that data.
Of course, but it's...
Right? It requires a high level of trust of the people, really, to give to the authorities that have that level of access.
And it is all about trust.
Yeah, it does. How much do you trust?
Well, to be honest, I'm not really sure that I trust phones at all. I don't like the fact that I have to warp my human sensibilities into some AI intelligence and remember long strings of numbers and change my codes all the time and do things that computers are really good at and that humans are really bad at just so that I can trust the computer. You know, I mean, it's already out of hand. It's already a machine in charge of my identity and my privacy, and we've already departed from the human scale of things.
Well, you see, Dr. Future sees this slightly differently.
Uh-huh.
I see the cell phone evolving into some kind of sixth sense, maybe 6.5 cents.
Oh, so you're going to embed the chip in your third eye?
No, it doesn't have to be connected. We're all wireless. We've developed the ability to communicate wirelessly. So naturally, living things like us would be able to communicate to other living things wirelessly. We do that with our language, with each other.
They used to call it ESP.
So our machines want at least that level of wireless connectivity so we have with each other.
Right. Well, I think ESP requires a certain amount of trust. You know, you have to trust yourself to be open to let your thoughts out there in the shared intelligence zone. And you have to trust that what you're viewing in that wireless zone is real, right? It still comes down to...
What you believe to be true. Like, for example, we have a link from John McAfee, who was the bad boy of Silicon Valley. He created the McAfee antivirus. You know, we know the guy who actually created it, so we understand how this area works. Now, what's interesting about McAfee is that he does have a security company, and he was recently on RT TV. You know, familiar with RT? It's kind of like the Russian version of CNN for us.
Yes, it's a Russian,
it's an interesting twist.
Russian television that's all English-speaking news anchors, and you never know, the spin on the story, but it's definitely going to be different than what you see in the West.
It's all propaganda. I mean,
it's all propaganda.
But then so is CNN. So
yeah. Everything except us is propaganda,
the same
right?
news from a different point of view, you know, which I like. I like having it, and that's one of the advantages of the internet as opposed to mainstream media. You have many more choices. Mm-hmm. So Bad Boy John blasts the FBI in this little video clip I have listed, and says that he could crack it in a few weeks without any problem. He doesn't have to go to
Apple. And he volunteered to do so, right?
Yeah, and he volunteered his services.
That's right. It's like, okay, so Justice Department, just let Apple off the hook on their principles, and I'll crack it for you.
Yeah,
no problem.
I don't have those issues.
I'll take the money. Right. But be it's true that we are creating a backdoor, so don't say that we're not creating a backdoor, because we are. And these are the people who are demonizing Snowden for letting the public know how much spying the government was doing.
And the suspicious would have to say, how much access does John have to secret Apple encryption information?
Probably as much as he wants.
So it's quite a hall of mirrors, folks.
Yeah. Well, the bottom line is, who can you trust? Can you trust your AI? Can you trust Apple Computer? Can you trust...
Start with yourself, I imagine.
Yourself. Yes, it has to start with yourself, doesn't it?
It does. And then to those closest to you, and maybe even your little smart machine in your pocket.
Yeah. Well, I'm a believer that transparency helps us trust, but I do think we have to have some way of differentiating all of these fraudulent access opportunities for people who have malevolent intent. So obviously I'm not skillful enough to even have a solution, but I do believe that transparency is better than secrets.
At least for these types of issues.
But that doesn't mean that I believe the government should compel Apple to disclose its secrets. I believe that that's wrong. That's sort of up there with governments ordering scientists to conduct secret research that is not in the benefit of the public good.
Well, here's the thing, is that there are so many secrets, so-called secrets, that are starting to come out in mass, that a lot of the things that were controlled by a handful of people in the past are now getting to be fast, cheap, and out of control.
Sure.
Including, you know, stuff like nuclear fusion and access to your computer, access to, you know, all these things are evolving very, very rapidly. So what's the answer to all this, right? What do? Do we hold on to the way things were and hope for the best?
Well, we're having a real crisis of belief and moral, what do they call it, moral compass. Because, you know, we used to have a lot of debates among the intelligentsia of the world about ethics. And we've kind of entered this time of secular beliefs where the church is not decreeing moral behavior. Or if it is, people are kind of deciding to do their own thing. And we're really in a new era of how to decide what's fair.
Well, that's why we have Catherine Austin Fitz on in the second hour.
Yeah.
Yeah, she starts to look at this. So it's fascinating with her point of view is that as somebody who was an insider in the White House.
Assistant Secretary to the Bureau of Housing and Urban Development.
Right. That would give her access to certain ways of thinking.
Yeah. And before that, she was a Wall Street financial analyst.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's
saw definitely, how that worked.
Right. She's an East Coast suit.
Yeah. And she's going to take us from an evolving solar system economy all the way down to the personal county economy in which we live and how all of this could work far better.
Yeah. Yeah, and her perspective, which I love, is always, she's very, very informed and is up on sort of all the bad news about
probably
the
heard
evils
her on
of
coast
modern
more than one
capitalism.
Occasion. Yeah.
But she is also an optimist and very moral in her approach to how to do right by the world. And she's in the school that you are doing your duty to God and your country by becoming affluent and being rich and basing that affluence in your community so that you are benefiting your community and making your community a safe, better place to live. So we're going to be talking about that stuff.
Yeah, let's get that in. I got some other things I want to share. No geeky data.
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, I know you're excited. I know you got her on. She actually got her on the show. I'm so proud of you. Okay, one of the things I really liked that it's a held over from the week before was a new biomedical tool that's as useful in biomedicine as lab rats. Now, I don't know how many of you are into the biomedical world, but you know that lab rats are big. We use literally millions of them for all the research going on. Now, this is a thing called a mini brain. It's like a quivering ball of nerve cells.
It's afraid. It's very, very afraid to be experimented
tiny
on.
Tiny orbs.
Tiny little neuron globes.
Swirling in lab dishes.
Mm-hmm.
And these are grown from stem cells derived from people's skin cells.
Wait, skin cells become brain cells?
Yes.
Huh. How does that work?
Well, because you turn skin cells into stem cells, and then from stem cells, you go to brain cells.
I see.
That kind of path.
All right, so you have these little jiggling balls in a petri dish, and now we no longer need lab rats?
No, we don't. As a matter of fact, very funny quote. This is from Hartung from the Johns Hopkins University.
36.
Okay. He says, we need something else other than these little mice for studying humans. He said, we are not 150-pound rats.
Well, that's a scientist for you. Okay, so he invented mini brains.
Mini brains, yes. Well, there are others more complicated. But these are like the Mini Coopers of the mini brains. There are Ferraris out there and stuff like that. But these can be used for everything, for studying nerve cells, support cells. All of it has a whole little ecosystem.
All right, which more you can, when we come back, folks. Dr. Future.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Mini brains. Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Yes, mini quivering brains. I think it's a great idea. And just the beginning, it'll be all kinds of little ecosystems representing all the different organs of the body. I mean, we're not going to stop with the brain. Mm-hmm. We're going to make little ecosystem, portable ecosystems of the entire body, all as testing grounds for various things, from electromagnetics to pharmacology. I think it's a very interesting precedent and really important to get away from simply working with animals. Mm-hmm. However, an interesting thing that is happening, and I'm just making a copy of an article on this topic, is the chimeric phenomenon. Chimeric, where we start to use the DNA from other life forms intermixed with human DNA.
Yes, and that word, you know, comes from ghost, right? A chimera is like a spirit that is from another world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now they're applying it to genetic cut and paste.
Yeah. And we're applying it to like growing body parts. I mean, we organ transplant lists are insanely long. You know, if you have a problem having a bad liver or kidney, you worry at this point. It's the dark ages because you may or may not get one before you die.
Because you have to get them from someone else who's dying, whose liver isn't bad.
And the way it's evolving is we'll be able to have spare parts much more easily. And, of course, we want them ones that actually work and not for other models of animals than us. You know,
right now, just in the last year, I would
parts,
say, I've been hearing lots and lots of people who are using stem cells to rebuild their cartilage.
Yeah.
You know, regrow parts of their body. And what they do is they extract the stem cells, they put them in some kind of a process where they mutate them maybe, and then they inject them back into the body as stem cells, right?
In the areas where you need the treatment.
Where you need the regrowth.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I have a number of friends into that. I haven't quite delved into that aspect of it just yet, but it looks pretty promising.
Right.
That it's getting affordable and people are starting to do it more and more, at least among my friends that I've seen.
Right. And so this really, it's sort of like your body is still in charge and it's just getting some new raw materials to use to
help fix whatever is in the area. Yeah.
Right.
It's like giving it raw food, raw materials for building things.
Right. But we're talking about in the future that these raw materials will actually create new organs and then somehow those organs will be used to replace your existing organs. Right.
And you'll be able to grow them quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Or in some cases, they're talking about 3D printing living tissue with laser-based 3D bioprinting.
Mm-hmm.
There's a group called the Open Biomedical Initiative that's into that. So laser-assisted 3D bioprinting technology, they're doing it. It's proprietary, it's private enterprise, but
right.
At least it's happening.
Right, and so this organization has been used to printing skin, right? And that's what they're doing. They're using lasers to do a stem cell process to turn skin into other things?
Yeah, skin seems to be capable of becoming stem cells. So far, that's been the most fruitful approach. It's a little too touchy to deal with embryonic stem cells. So if our own skin cells work just as well, why not?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're shedding them all the time anyway. I hope you do a good show on it, Michael. Michael likes the chimeric studies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing, is that the combination of human and animal, though the lines are starting to get blurred. And if you start to think of, for example, in our culture where you want to enhance your body, you know, people will do steroids and various drugs and certain exercise routines to build the body that they want. But what if you could have like some animal blood in you to change your muscle timber in a way that that animal uses, like wolf or something
like that? I believe
our
circle of friends has been calling it becoming a GMO human.
Yeah, yeah. Initially for medical reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can grow a pig heart in 100 days as opposed to waiting for a pure human part, you know, which would take,
you know, you have months. Such a sci-fi sense of wonder, right? I mean,
well, I see myself where this has already all happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a part of me that's already
you're going to grow yourself a pig heart.
No, it ultimately goes to 100% parts of your own DNA, right?
Uh-huh.
It goes to but in the meantime, there's this pathway that makes it an interesting story where we use other creatures' parts. And then
you sound so much like Baron Harkonnen. I mean, it's really probably hard for people to believe what a beautiful heart you do have because your fascination sounds so demento, you know?
Well, it's not. It's not separate to me. I see us as an awareness of all creatures. They're all part of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally, we play with the whole ball of wax, you know, because it's all us on some level. And to be aware of how that is.
So as an evolutionary agent,
you just feel like nature
has created this palette and it's all fair game.
To a certain part of our consciousness, yes. In terms of what we actually create, no, we have to tune that into whatever culture or environment we're in or whatever time period we're in.
And I guess you're kind of feeling like, well, just because we can recognize the pattern at the DNA level that makes an animal, there's no violation if somehow we decide to utilize that pattern in a new way.
Well, if you come from animal mind, right, all of us have animal minds. In our evolutionary path, you've probably heard these stories of how the fetus goes through a fish phase and
That somehow the whole cycle
reptilian.
Of evolution that gets us from primordial soup to the beings that we are.
It's all us.
Recapitulated
right?
as we go from a fetus to a full-on body.
Ontology recapitulates biology, I think, something like that.
What's the phrase? Ontology recapitulates.
I think that's for
philology
plants.
Or something.
that's not quite right, but see, that's what I mean. It's a pattern that occurs through time and through many species, and an awareness that.
Yeah, it's a blueprint. It's a blueprint for life that has been created over billions of years and has been reproducing itself perfectly every generation, and has been mutating very slowly over time, because the time is the test of what works. And here we're accelerating our ability to mess with the system and maybe create a lot of things that won't work and maybe create things that will interfere with the stability that we have been accustomed to.
Yeah. Well, it's important to brainstorm all this because we do think about things before we actually do anything, you know,
that's
these worlds.
True.
And so it's important. I think that's where talk radio is really great, where we can all put our heads together on these things and see what's the highest option.
Yeah, there is a big gap between imagination and reality.
Yeah.
And there is a big conversation that has to move us forward.
And here's the thing, is that a lot of stuff that was science fiction a short while ago is now pretty real. And it has implications in how we think about things.
Like what? Give us some examples. What are you thinking of?
Like, for example, the ethical issue of eating meat.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, the old omnivore's dilemma. Once meat is no longer harming an animal and is what some of our friends are calling poop burgers.
Well, as Charles Ostman once got me, as he said, you kill an animal and go through all what that means, and that's not a problem for you. Fine, go do that. But you don't have to. What if you could not do any of that and you could just have a steak? You could just print a steak.
Mm-hmm.
Print a steak. Right? That's it. And it's not.
Yeah, you know, the old moral, Star Trek holodeck.
No moral
computer,
dilemma involved.
Print me
in,
a cup of tea, Earl Grey hot, and a steak.
Yeah, and you've.
Made out of nanomolecules.
Yeah, and whatever suffering you were creating before goes away.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that species mostly dies too. We probably wouldn't breed cows anymore, so the entire cattle industry would go away.
Well, I think you fail to appreciate the self-determination of the other creatures that are not human. It may have been a mutually beneficial relationship with us using our intelligence to create more of them because they're our food, but they are sovereign intelligences as well. They have a place in the cosmic design.
Well, certainly in the Hindu culture, the cows roam freely in the streets.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and part
they have
of
a different
being
relationship
a
with
sentient
them.
Being yeah. is to understand how everything in the universe has its own perfection and its own unique place in divinity and to be caring of that, you know, to appreciate and steward it, not to just kind of act like, oh, I'm the only thing that's important here and I don't care if I smash everything on my way to oblivion, you know.
Yeah, it's important not to be too species-centric,
uh-huh.
you know, though we do tend to think of ourselves as number one. It's our planet.
Well, and to really give your intelligence the mystery of all of the things that have been created in the universe with you, to not be so blind that you're missing it, right? Nature is the great teacher. So you want to pay attention, not miss the beauty.
Yeah, well, that's why we're here, man. And yeah. It's mostly surrounded by nature to remember these things.
Yeah, memory. So time for another break, and then we'll be back with a few more headlines from the doctor.
Yes, yes, there's a way of making smart skin out of recyclable materials.
Okay.
Fascinating.
We'll be right back.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. It's all going infinity really fast, man. Wait, check this out. In Kurzweil Accelerating Intelligence News, external 5D data storage could reliably record the history of humankind. Digital documents stored in nanostructured dots infused quartz crystal for billions of years could survive the end of the human race.
Hmm.
Yeah.
More secure than planets, huh?
Here's the thing. You can store 360 terabytes per disk on this, up to a temperature of 1,000 degrees centigrade and at room temperature for 13.8 billion years.
So 360 terabytes.
13.8 billion years. So that's
per disk.
Yeah. So that would be highly stable and that would...
Well, here, let me give you a little reference like from our friend Mark, who has measured how many megabytes of memory is necessary to record in video and audio every
current
second
form,
of
standard
your
definition,
life
then we,
from birth till death, yeah. If you live 100 years. And I think he calculated it would be 70 terabytes, something like that.
Given the existing technology.
Right.
But we're going to use more bandwidth.
Uh-huh.
Guaranteed.
Right.
I mean, the 3D virtual reality
well,
stuff
we'll
coming up later
more
this year.
Dimensions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you want more dimensions, more information. You know, you want...
I'm just saying, you could store a family of five on a on yeah. one of these 5D discs with Mark's life logging technology.
So why would you want to do that? Well, one would be rebooting our civilization. Like we could create a civilization reboot that...
Let's not call it a reboot. Let's call it a duplicate. Because, you know, we don't need to reboot it if we just continue going the way we are with our immortality intact through good practices of living on the planet and appreciating life.
Well, our species would then put a really nice seed into the matrix of nature.
We have already. We are a really nice seed in the matrix of nature.
So this would be one that would last the length of the universe, which is something that I don't think usually happens on the planet, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we're adding a new thing to the 17 other million species on this planet to be able to create an eternity for us.
Right. So we're talking about freezing something so that it doesn't change for billions of years. Doesn't sound very alive,
freezing something,
though.
No, it's memory. You know, it can be living memory. It can involve the videos of all the times of history, of all the cultures. It can be a living memory.
Okay. It's a hard drive.
Yeah.
It's basically a crystal quartz hard drive.
Yeah. That's one way to think about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's more than a hard drive. It's going to involve everything we know. It'll involve AI.
Mm-hmm. And it can't get too close to the sun because it can only go up to 1,000 degrees.
Until it figures out through its own intelligence how to do that.
Uh-huh.
Right.
How to put itself into a coat of protective armor.
Yeah, so mere speculation, but eternal 5D data storage could reliably exist, given the existing technology.
And so what would you store there?
Everything that we do.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, it's...
So the entire Dr. Future archives of tapes that you've been recording since you were in your 20s?
Well, you record... Everyone's life is available to themselves all the time.
Uh-huh.
All through the past, and we can have selective forgetting. We mostly do that now with our biological memory. We selectively forget and remember, you know, in depending on the circumstances that we are in or the phase of life that we're in. But this sort of storage will allow you to more instantly access like other periods of your life in the moment much more completely and quickly.
It sounds like it allows you to store it, but I don't know that it allows you to access it. It sounds like a giant universe of stored stuff. It would be a long time to find the stuff you're looking for.
Storage is just the beginning for this. I think it's a living
retrieval,
storage.
Followed by retrieval.
Yeah, those go together. It's like attention and memory. It's a big topic, but I have an article on it. It's the University of Southampton Optoelectronics Research Center. The first digital data storage system capable of creating archives that can survive for billions of years. And you might wonder why we would ever want anything like that. But we've invented it, so there.
It already exists. Now, what shall we store there?
What would you store?
We have the time capsule. What's worth remembering that long?
13.7 billion. I thought the universe was 14.7 billion years, so we need to improve. Part of the hope is that if we have better memory systems, we won't repeat the stupid mistakes of the past. And as a species, learn to evolve and not go back into some stupid traps.
Oh, okay, right.
Sent us into the dark ages.
If we can remember our mistakes, then we won't be doomed to repeat them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and what are those lessons? And one of those lessons was memory, is that if you can remember, then you will, or you're more likely to act on it than if you don't remember.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I just love the way that you have cultivated your memories over the years and how... Now that you are in the process of copying them forward, they're actually fresh. Like you get to experience yourself as a 20-year-old again. You get to experience yourself as somebody who's hanging out with your parents.
Now she's referring to the fact that I've been digitizing tapes that I made 20, 30 years ago mm-hmm. and putting that into an online NAS.
Right.
It's true. When you look at yourself in other periods in time, it brings that into your front brain. Brings it into, or a psychologist would be your short-term memory, your working memory.
Yeah. Yeah, well, memory is an experiential playback device because reality is real time. It's in the moment. It happens, and then it's done. And memory is the
replay of
what happens, right?
And then reflecting back into the moment. So you use your memories to plan your next move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then memories become the foundation of the next dimensions after the 3D space of here and now. the foundation of here and now is your thoughts, and then what your thoughts can create. So you can create memories, you can create beliefs, you can create inventions, you can create treaties. All of those things come from your memories. So if we have a good way of restoring our memories, of keeping our memories and then bringing them back.
Yeah. Well, it's at retrieval, and then there's knowing to intelligently use the system once you have one that can do all these things. Mm-hmm. There are many things that we're learning about being here. One of the things that's driving this are issues like physical rehab and athlete training. You know, a lot of the new paradigms that will lead us to having a more aware consciousness starts with having the technology designed for things that might be wrong with you.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very interesting piece from the University of Bielefeld in Germany. They have a new system of virtual training room that helps users practice and improve sports exercises for their athletes in their school. It's a virtual coaching space. They teach you to do everything from simple things like squat exercises to very complex moves of advanced yoga. They're using a system where it looks like your coach is standing in front of you and you have a personal coach watching your every move and commenting on it. So unlike a real yoga coach where she goes from one person to another, she or he goes and looks at your posture or pose, you're constantly getting feedback from your yoga AI. One of the things about machine intelligence is that it has unlimited attention for you, as no other person or friend or loved one can give, because they have their own lives to live and the machines don't, at least yet. Most important thing is you. So naturally, the AI teachers will have unlimited attention for your quirks and quarks and the way that you think. And this is an example of how that's evolving. So very interesting article.
Yeah, this one's pretty interesting because it is a real live existing virtual reality research project.
Yeah.
And it involves the person who is putting on the goggles, seeing themselves in a training room and seeing their own body in a mirror inside of that virtual space. So
they see themselves too. Yeah.
They see themselves, and there is a ability to superimpose the trainer's body and model of what you should be doing on top of your own body in the virtual space.
So you can see how accurate your perceptions are by actually looking at an overlay.
Right.
Yeah.
So that virtual world is definitely of interest to people who want to improve reality. Or escape reality, I guess, because you're basically covering your eyes and using that cover to give yourself a new place to be.
But hey, if you get more in your body as a result of being like out of your body, mm-hmm. isn't that a bonus?
One would hope. Yeah. You have free will. You can use it however you want.
So as VR gear gets more common, you're going to start seeing stuff like this entering into the world. And which virtual trainer should I get?
Boy, I can just see the Gold's Gym of the future. Instead of having all of those treadmills lined up at the window, you'll have a bunch of people with goggles sort of maybe strapped into a padded room where they can like move around and not hurt themselves while they have various virtual adventures.
I'll pay a dollar for that.
Okay, sounds good. All right, well, listen, folks, the next hour is going to be entirely different than the first hour because
yes.
we are going to be speaking with Catherine Austin Fitz about it's called money mapping. And money mapping is about how to improve reality in your own neighborhood by knowing where the money is.
She's going to help us all be more successful.
Yeah. We're big fans of Catherine Austin Fitz and the Solari Report. And, of course, you may have heard her on Coast to Coast or other radio interviews that she does. She's really enlightening. And we'll be taking some questions at the end of that hour. So stay tuned for more of the Dr. Future Show. We'll be back. This is Dr. Future Show on KSCO Santa Cruz and wherever you are.
Talk to you soon.